All right, we can get started on the ROI panel. Of course, is it art or is it science? You can see the background of the panelists. But I want to lead off and just kind of put this into context, if I could. Oncology is the most crowded therapeutic area in medicine today in terms of pipeline. And this slide, by the way, covers only the 1,000 compounds that are in the clinic. It does not cover preclinical or platforms. So again, just think of this ocean, over 1,000 compounds in clinical trials. About 40% of those are in phase 1, 45% in phase 2, and 15% in phase 3 or registration. That's 150 compounds in phase 3 or registration. And that sounds exciting, but we all know in oncology, a lot of the smaller companies go from phase 1 to phase 3. So I would submit to you that a lot of what people classify as phase 3s, that's probably not the case. So of the 1,047 companies in the clinic, about 75% are in the hands of the smaller companies. Or another way to look at it is 15 companies only control 25% of the oncology pipeline. So there are 750 compounds out there in this ocean, you know, called the oncology pipeline. Now, a lot of the deals that happen generally happen in that magical phase 2. And the question is, do you have proof of principle? Do you have proof of concept? And as we all know, a lot of the phase 2s historically have not predicted the phase 3s. Now, as a BD consultant and advisor to a lot of the smaller oncology companies, we consistently hear that while this area has huge quantity, the problem is low quality. Now, when it comes to ROI, the challenge is that of those 1,000 compounds out there, very few of those are in late-stage phase 3, and thus you're looking at metrics that no longer apply traditionally. So what do people look at in the banking industry? What's your PE? What's your revenue potential? What's your discounted cash flow? So a lot of the classical metrics that you can use in BD and M&A are completely irrelevant in oncology. And that makes this area both an art and at times a science, but much more an art. So I'm excited today to announce that we've got three representatives, one from Big Pharma, one from Venture Capital, and one from Big Biotech. And all three of these are out there in this giant ocean fishing. And I'd love to hear from these guys, you know, how do they catch, what do they use for the bait, and how do they look at this area, which is very amorphous. So I want to start with Srini, who will give the venture capital portfolio. Then I'll turn over to Juan, and then I'll let George give some comments as well from Celgene's perspective, since they've been very active on both the BD as well as the M&A area. Srini?
Thanks, Mark. So Mark assures me that people are interested in understanding how we value companies or think about exits and how we kind of make up information to kind of justify why we do these deals. I personally find that unfathomable, but I'm happy to go through it if you guys actually agree with Mark that that this is interesting. You know, what's not on these slides, look, at the end of the day, I think we'll get into this a little bit later, but you guys all know this, risk is inversely correlated to value. So we invest, we put money in, we hopefully do some experiments and generate data that reduces risk, and therefore increases value. And fundamentally, as a venture capitalist, what I'm looking for in any company, whether it's oncology or non-oncology, is do we have data after we spend this money that makes me more comfortable to put more money into this company? Quite frankly, ultimately, at the end of the day, if we're helping patients, something good is going to happen. You know, we'll make money as venture capitalists. You know, more importantly, patients will benefit. But that's the road to how we're all successful, obviously, when we do this business. But in oncology, there are obviously certain aspects of some of these deals that we do that allows us, hopefully, to be maybe slightly more efficient about where we can get to that reduce risk, increase value, and how we can see that path forward, and how we can fund it as venture capitalists. That's the one sort of bias from our perspective. Can we fund it? And we heard a few things yesterday about what's the best way to really try to explore the best regimens, you know, the best combinations. You know, quite frankly, we can't do that. And Eric Rowinsky, I think, said, look, that's not realistic for small biotech companies, so we have to look for companies where single-agent activity is actually feasible. That's kind of, you know, obviously very difficult. But, you know, whether it's single-agent or a combination, it has to be a clearly venture-financeable, realistic clinical program that actually increases value in a way that's not debatable. Okay, so going through, and again, it's ROI in cancer, but I'll go through an example of a non-cancer company, actually, just to give you a sense of how we do this. Broadly, valuation, you know, we think about what do we pay for a company, what are we willing to pay for a company. Sometimes we look at the ultimate exit valuation and work backwards. This is what we think the company could be worth if everything works out great, and we have to put X amount of dollars into it over multiple rounds of financing, and therefore, working backwards, you know, the max we can pay is Y. Or we'll actually do some fundamental analysis of valuation, and this is, you know, probably just at NPV, things that I learned when I was at Genentech before going to venture from some of the people in this audience like Bob Cohen here taught me how to do this and think about these drugs and think about the risk associated with it. I gave him a plug, so he's going to make sure to ask a, you know, an easy question when I get to that. Anyways, so that's an important part of it, and we try to triangulate essentially on where this is eventually going, what are the risks associated with it. High risk means high return. We have to kind of be able to see that possibility. Low risk, we're willing to take a lower return and therefore pay more money, or, you know, again, it, what goes into the equation is really how much money actually goes into it. So these are all fundamental parts of this. In oncology in particular, again, compared to other therapeutic areas, there are some advantages, hopefully, to getting some earlier exits. And certainly we've seen good examples of that over the last few years of companies that are either preclinical or early clinical that have actually been able to get the exit. But you know, there's some obvious things about why for venture capitalists, again, this is interesting. We can finance two, we can go straight into phase one, we can finance that, and we can look for activity in patients. In the past, you know, certainly that was always something people tried to avoid trying to promise. We don't want activity, we're looking for safety, we're trying to get to the, you know, a justification to go to phase two, and 75% of drugs go to phase two, so what have you really learned? For us as venture capitalists, we have to feel like there's a possibility that we're actually going to see some activity here, and that goes to some of the, you know, newer therapeutics that we've all seen in the last several years that actually showed robust activity. So that's a little bit of a different hurdle for us, I think, than a big pharma company that can justifiably take something forward and really look to multiple phase twos to actually understand if they got a drug or not. And, you know, again, these other aspects, the biomarkers are obviously very important to help us understand where we're going. And targeted therapeutics, I'll go through a little bit, have had a higher, you know, in the last several years, again, have had a higher probability of success. Okay, this is some slides, similar to some slides that Jeff showed yesterday. Oncology at the very end, you know, showing the lowest probability of success, and you know, these are various different types of cancers and different rates of success. What's to us, you know, more interesting is some of the kinase inhibitors and targeted therapeutics have actually had higher than historical probability of success. And you know, again, this is important as we think about, it's not just, this talks about overall probability of success. We're looking at, in some cases, going all the way through, and I think that's going to happen more and more with venture capitalists. But we're also looking at a substantial reduction, again, in risk and substantial, hopefully, increase in value with earlier programs that show some of these kind of activities. Okay, and this is played out, again, in the last few years, some examples of M&A that's occurred with phase one data at the top and then with phase three. And these are pretty meaningful deals, total of three to $400 million acquisitions, with about half of that up front or a little more than half of that up front, with phase one data, and then with phase three, $400 million up front with, you know, $700 to $800 million of value down the road. Obviously very important for us, and again, some of these programs, these are ones that with a syndicate of two or three other venture groups, we can actually finance all the way through to that. I'll give you a case study that we actually did, and these are numbers that we were in our memo. I just kind of try to anonymize this. This is a deal we did a few years ago, and I use it. It's not an oncology company, but I use it because it's got a product and it's got platform, just to give you a sense of how we think about both aspects of this. So this had two products. One was a little bit more advanced than the other, and then it had a platform that could produce a lot of different products. And it was an interesting differentiated platform. So we valued each separately. We actually did several scenarios on pricing and probability of success, and this was obviously probability of success once the company spent the money that we're putting in. So it's a higher probability of success than normal for a variety of reasons, which I won't go into, but it also is higher than the initial time of investment, because we're assuming here that we put the money in, they actually do the work, and things are positive. And so what is this company worth at the end of that? So we took that as a sum of the parts, product X, product Y, and then the platform, and tried to come up with a base case valuation. This is returns, you know, that have happened over the last number of years on on, you know, products and platforms, and that was also a part of the triangulation of the value. And then we put that together, and again, had ranges based on the money that we put in immediately, and then we also do range for exit valuations based on another round of financing. And, you know, again, in biotech venture, you always assume the other round of financing. Whether you're CEO, venture capitalist, or not, you gotta assume that. And so this is, you know, realistically, the scenario two, even this list is two, is really our base case to have more money go into the company, in this case, $30 million more with us putting 10 more in. But hopefully that leads to a higher valuation. And then we look at the ranges and see if that's, that makes sense in terms of what's acceptable for us and our LPs. And, of course, we're doing that in the context of what the company realistically can be valued based on the comps and based on what the probability, based on the net present value of those of the products that the company has. Okay, that's all I had. You know, I'll mention one other thing. We, you know, Mark, you know, because I got a lot of slides, that, you know, we cut out some slides on another company that I did, a company called Pyramid that Roche bought. But that was, you know, in, when you look at ROI for cancer, I think it was a good example of some of the things that I mentioned. We were first in class essentially in PI3 kinase inhibitors. And we were able to get, because of that, we had a fair bit of interest from Big Pharma to do a licensing deal. We did a deal with Genentech for U.S. rights and kept the ex-U.S. rights. And as the program continued and progressed, we were able to sell that to Roche, and we actually got a nice return on it. But the key point being that we got a lot of non-dilutive capital that came in. And again, as this didn't have to have a lot of progress in the development for us to be an interesting acquisition candidate. You know, certainly a molecule that can be that can be combined with a lot of different chemotherapeutics. And one of the reasons we did the licensing deal, not just with non-dilutive capital, which was really important, is because ultimately this was going to the right development pathway for that molecule was, you know, 10 phase twos. I mean, if you really want to do it right. And that's, again, not financeable for us, but a great way to actually reduce risk, move things forward, get big pharma or big biotech involved, and actually have the proper development, higher probability of success, as we saw yesterday, but also ultimately get to a pretty nice return.
Thank you, Srini, for the venture capital perspective. Julio, if we can hear the big pharma perspective.
So we're going in escalating order of dress code, sweater, jacket, and finally tie.
Or usually on the other end.
Or market cap.
Or market cap. All right. So I only have two slides, and I'm hoping to give you sort of a crash course in financial valuation in two slides. So this is not necessarily specific to oncology, but this is how we approach trying to come up with what is the value of an asset at BMS and also at other places where I've worked, of course. So as you go from a scientific platform or technology to something that's actually on the market, the uncertainties decrease, so it's tougher to put a value, an actual dollar value around a technology. As a bit of background, before I had less gray hair, I actually worked on the PCR deal where we licensed PCR to Roche, and at that point PCR was very early and we didn't really know what is the potential for it, and trying to come up with a value in terms of what we were going to get for a milestone payment royalty stream was extremely difficult. So nothing has changed. Technologies are very tough to put a value around. What we try to do at BMS is if we want to make an investment in technology, we discuss, well, you know, is there a way that we can estimate, is this going to increase the potential probability of success for some of our assets? Those kind of analyses you can do, but it's still very difficult. Then as you get into the early stage molecules where you can actually think about what is the market potentially for this molecule, in the very early stages, you may have a mechanism of action, but you may not know what tumors you're going to go into. So, again, those estimates are very difficult. So you can use, you know, generic assumptions. You can take a look at historical data, that kind of thing, and just plug that in if you need to do some kind of very quick valuation. But ultimately, what we do for the very early compounds is we don't really put necessarily values around them. What we do is we tend to prioritize because now we're looking at portfolio decisions. So we take a look at all our early compounds and we come up with, you know, multi-criteria decision analysis. We take a look at, you know, which ones have more validated proof of concept, which ones might be easier to develop, those kind of things. And what we do then is we come up with a ranking of our early compounds that we can then figure out if we have to make trade-offs in terms of resourcing or adding dollars to, then we have at least some criteria to work with. Then as you get into later stage molecules, then you have more information and you can actually develop a true valuation model and come up with a value for what you think that molecule is worth. And I'll get into in the next slide, you know, the techniques that we use to do that. But, I mean, it's a mixed audience, so some of you, it's just going to be very, very simplistic, and for some of you, maybe it won't be. And I can get into more details at lunch if anybody's interested. So, again, for the earlier compounds, multi-criteria decision analysis to do rankings and not necessarily come up with an actual value. And then for later stage molecules and life cycle indications, you can actually come up with values and ranges around that. So how do we do that? So on the left, you have a decision tree or an outcome tree, if you will. Each node is an outcome. So in the first one, we have your phase one study. You can have success or failure and then have some arbitrary numbers there for probability. Then you can move, if you're successful, you move to phase two, successful phase three, and then successful phase three, you go to the FDA and the regulatory agencies, and if you're successful there, you're on the market. Very simplistic, right? I mean, obviously there's many other ways, depending on how you're developing something, that this could play out, but in the very simplistic model, for illustration, that's how it works out. So the little charts, the tiny charts in yellow, that represents either expenditures or revenues. The lines are very small, but if you see each time you fail, if you fail in phase one, you incur your phase one costs. If you fail in phase two, you incur your phase two and phase one costs, so on and so forth. And the only time you ever get into the blue, the revenues coming in, that's when you have success. So there's an expected probability for each of those occurring. So for each of those, the expected development costs are really multiply the probability times the probability of that expenditure, add that all up, and those are your expected development costs. There's a time value of money aspect also that you have to take into account, discounted cash flows. And then you take your overall expected net present value, and we can, you know, we do modeling around that. It's not just one number. And then the PI is what we use at BMS and other places. So PI, productivity index, is the ROI measure that we prefer. Really, it's the expected net present value divided by your expected development cost. There's a lot that goes into this in terms of, you know, ranges, the inputs, how do you estimate the probability of technical and regulatory success. A lot of details go into it, but ultimately the way we look across compounds, not just in oncology, is we look at the expected net present value, we look at PI, and that's how we calculate it. Then in terms of portfolio decisions, we can take a look at if we want to have a portfolio mix of less risky and more risky compounds. That's a whole other discussion. But in terms of how we look at ROI at Big Pharma, this is typically how we do it.
Fantastic. Thank you, Julio. George, if we can switch to get a big biotech perspective, and at Celgene, you've done platform deals with Agios, you've done clinical deals with Avila, and also a deal in terms of commercial products with Abraxas.
Yeah. So it is still morning. Good morning. I took a pass on the slides. I think for those of you in the corporate world, so much time is spent making PowerPoint that I decided not to subject you and mostly myself to a few more PowerPoint slides. And I'm going to just take you through four examples of deals we've done going chronologically backwards, and I'll talk about each of those, and I think you'll see how it works at Celgene, which is not really dissimilar from what the previous panelists have stated. So if we begin with the most recent deal that's been announced, this was Celgene's acquisition of Avila, which was done because really for two fundamental reasons. They have a BTK inhibitor at the end of phase one, one could almost argue near the beginning of phase two, that is in development for B-cell malignancies, may also work in B-cell mediated chronic inflammatory states. This was a mechanism and a drug that we liked extremely well. We think it will be one of the cornerstones of CLL, NHL therapy going forward. And we initially began discussions with Avila about a licensing deal. Once we got to know them, we deeply appreciated their platform, which is solely devoted to the discovery and ultimate development of covalently bound drugs. We thought the quality of the scientific team was extraordinary, and the potential to enhance Celgene's long-term pipeline was there. So it was actually very easy for us to make a classical financial model for the BTK inhibitor, where we could go in and do a patient-based forecast, which indications are we likely to develop and get registered. One will look at the indication, make a patient-based forecast, put a probability assessment on each of those indications. For those of you who don't do this for a living, a lot of discussion and debate goes into it, but in the end, you're guided by some of the statistics that Srini showed, and somebody finally says, well, it's 30% or it's 35%. This is not, a big supercomputer does not spit out a number. It's a little bit of intelligent throwing of darts at a dartboard. So we had that piece. And then when you get to the platform piece, I would completely agree with what Julio has stated. It really is impossible to value in a financial model, you know, drugs that are not even discovered yet, targets that are not even named yet. So if you actually look at the Avala deal, what was publicly disclosed, frankly speaking, roughly half of the value in the end of the overall deal was probably placed on the BTK asset, and about half of it was placed on the platform. It's easy to justify the half that was put on the BTK asset. We have the models, we have the equations, and one, you know, is really unable to value the platform piece. But again, Celgene is a company that is doing very well now financially. It's time for us to build our short, medium, and long-term pipeline. This was a brilliant fit. So we did it, and we were very happy to do that. If we go back to the next deal, chronologically speaking again, this was our rather interesting, from my perspective, collaboration with the very, very young startup coming out of Stanford, Quantacell, which was really a company that had been seed-funded by Versant Ventures, was still embryonic. Our scientists got onto their core technology as potentially transformative in the drug discovery arena, and perhaps even more importantly in the biomarker area. They're able to disaggregate tumors, pick individual cells, and one can follow exquisitely the sort of evolution of a tumor under drug treatment, under control conditions in the lab, or actually coming out of patients. Versant and the management of Quantacell did not want to have a syndicate funding them. There were specific reasons about the way the equity was deployed in the company, and they did not want to engage in a collaboration with a Celgene or anyone else that was built around a licensing deal or a collaboration. So we ultimately landed on a deal model, which in this case worked very well, although it kept a lot of lawyers and auditors sleepless at night for the complexity of it. But the bottom line is Celgene stepped in with Versant to start up the company. We put in a large amount, $45 million is publicly disclosed, of capital up front. Some of that was to purchase a rather small amount of equity. The rest of that was non-dilutive and went into the company. And they will run for 3 years. And at the end of 3 years, we can either buy them at a price that is calculated by some formula, it is not a fixed price, or we can renew for a year and then have the option to buy them at that point, or we can walk away and say this just didn't work for us. I just would go out and say there's just no way you can look at that and value that from an ROI or DCF model. This, again, was we thought the technology was potentially disruptive and could really transform the treatment of patients that we're seeking to serve in the, you know, really 7 to 10 year time frame. Okay, going backwards, the next deal then, Abraxis. This was a company that was really had multiple products in development, but we really wanted to acquire Abraxis for its ownership of Abraxane, the nanoparticle paclitaxel formulation, which was already approved in metastatic breast cancer in both Europe and the U.S. Was, we believe, based on the diligence, highly likely to gain approval in non-small cell lung cancer, first line, and actually had rather remarkable data associated with an ongoing pivotal study in pancreatic cancer. Here, you can well imagine that we built a very sophisticated model. We knew what the sales were in breast. We took a stab at what we could do if we promoted the drug, what kind of uplift we could get there. We projected when we would get an approval for non-small cell lung cancer, built revenues, again, on a patient-based forecast. Probability of success there was extremely high. They had hit their SPA-driven endpoint. And we then built a similar forecast for pancreatic cancer, took a different probability of success, and out comes a very, very clear ability to calculate an NPV. What do we think the drug is worth? A probabilized NPV, and they are different. And, of course, another key driver for this deal, which was $2.9 billion cash, and actually rather remarkably had payments on the back end because although Abraxas was a public company, it was 82% owned by one individual. And this was actually, in some ways, a godsend for the deal because it allowed us to resolve certain disputes about valuation by saying, look, we don't think this drug is going to sell quite what you think, but if it does, we'll share some of that with you. So there are milestone payments. There are actually, in fact, I applaud Celgene for this. I think this was one of the first deals where there are publicly traded CVRs, CELGZ, on the market for people who are waiting for those milestones to come true. The other thing that we looked at in addition to ROI, NPV, is, and this I think is very important for any of you who are in the venture business or in the small company business, for sure for a deal of that kind, we looked very carefully at earnings per share impact. Is this accretive? Is this dilutive? Any publicly traded company in certainly the U.S., and I would argue Europe as well, is very sensitive to earnings per share upticks or downticks. And the irony is there can be a lot of cash sitting on the balance sheet in the bank, and companies want to use that cash to grow their business, but things start to struggle and stumble a little bit if they have to then turn around and pay large development costs quarter to quarter. It stinks, but it's a fact of life in the world we live in. So this is something we looked at very carefully. And again, this was classic DCF model, looked at for all those parameters. It's easy to do. How accurate it will be in 10 years is subject to debate, and somebody will look at that. But it was very easy to build that kind of a model. The final deal is much more like Quantacell that I'll talk about. That was our large collaboration, not an option to buy, not an acquisition, with Agios, which was quite further along than Quantacell when we did the deal. They had no desire to be acquired. We believe this was an extremely fine, uniquely positioned company in the cancer cell metabolism space. You know, David Schenkein had hired a great team. There were emerging data with respect to their lead program, IDH1, and several others that this could perhaps be a remarkable broad treatment modality for cancer patients going forward to exploit what we now know about cancer cell metabolism and how many of the mutations are actually in some ways unique to cancer cells, that the cancer cells are also addicted to the misutilization or overutilization of glucose or other metabolites, and there are mutations that you can target in the cancer cells. So this became very complicated as well, and we ended up putting $120 million of largely non-dilutive capital into Agios to allow us to collaborate with them and have options to anything they came up with in the oncology space for as little as 3 and as much as 6 years. And it's very interesting. You can well imagine here, again, chances of building a model, zero. One, we were driven by what we thought it would take to accomplish the mission, if the mission could be accomplished. Again, I think it's very important to remember for companies that are seeking growth, and this is true of most of the large net buyers, we have a lot of cash sitting around. We need to build our business. You can leave your money in the bank. You can dividend it out, but it's far better to pick the best science and place a bet on it. And I'll tell you this anecdote, which happens to be true, which I think gets at valuation in some of these deals. So when this deal was presented to the Celgene board, I was asked several questions, but one of them was, so we understand this is really a great technology and could produce great value for the company down the road, but is it possible that nothing might come out of this? And I said, well, there is that possibility. This is a green field, and we don't think so for all the reasons stated, but that's absolutely possible. And I think much to Celgene's credit, the director who asked that question said, that's exactly what I thought. I still think we should do this. So I think I'll end my comments about ROI and financial valuations with that. Thank you.
So a question for the panelists. Early stage molecule, early stage company, you're in the room, you've done your models. In the end, how impactful is ROI? In the end, are really the intangibles that drive the early stage, or do you actually rely on some of these models out to 2028?
Again, I think I won't, for those of you who know me, I also had a
relatively long stint in a big pharma company. The amazing thing to me, based on my experience, is that all companies build models, which in, when a model can be built, are actually relatively similar in terms of how they're built, what they look at. But what the different companies focus on or obsess about is actually quite different, remarkably so. One company was always worried about probabilized NPV and how much did they get versus how much we get. Another company was really worried about ROI, just, you know, when are we get our money back and, you know, how long is it going to take? Other companies probably are much more driven by EPS. You know, Mark, I don't think there is any company out there who can do early stage deals. An early phase one compound where you don't even know the indication in cancer yet that can will ever do such a deal if they're driven by the model, right? And I think Julio commented quite well. You at that stage, you're prioritizing by the science. I mean, I think, Mark, you said there's a big ocean out there. So, you know, many of you in the audience who are not working in companies, business development functions, might find this interesting or surprising. But, you know, when I first moved into oncology from 5 or 6 years working on CNS drugs, I thought, boy, this is great. You know, there are thousands of drugs. This is going to be easy. And after about a year, I was, you know, it's amazing how much stuff is out there that really is just not, I mean, I hate to say this, but is not going to make it. The science is not sound. The target is not validated. They've done a trial against, you know, they put their drug on top of a standard chemo regimen. There's no control arm, and, oh, this is going to work. So it's actually relatively easy to prioritize the best compounds in phase one based on the science. And that's what you have to look at.
Julio Bristol, what's your... In the end, when you're in that room, you've got to make that magical decision, yes or no?
I agree with all that. And for the early compounds, again, we don't look at numbers, financials. We look at other metrics. If we see a compound, whether it's internal or external, that can help fill maybe a phase two gap that we have, or it's going to have synergy of mechanism with another compound that's further along, those are the kind of things that we look at for the very early stage compounds, really.
Yeah. Rainey, your view from the VC perspective?
Sure, and actually, I'll add a little bit from, you know, I was at Genentech in business development before I did this. I just mentioned that, and, you know, we did do some probably just at NPVs, and quite frankly, you know, it was a massive range because the assumptions can be so, you know, are the most important variables in that, and those are some, even small tweaks can make a big difference. So we did do that, although, you know, I did actually try to make the argument that we should do a sunk cost analysis rather than looking at it as probably just an NPV from the time that we do the deal to we're going to spend $20 million at the end of $20 million. Here's, you know, now we can actually make a more realistic probably just an NPV. People weren't actually so wild about that, but I do think, as I mentioned, that's how we look at it in VC. So it's, you know, it's irrational to do these deals to begin with. So if you want to try to layer on a coat of rationality, we try to do a little bit of that, as I said, but particularly as you go earlier and earlier, it's kind of a waste of time. You have to have some vision, you know, whether, you know, we had that in Pyramid, Mike Powell had it in Telekine. I don't know if he did a, you know, probably just an NPV for that. Just said, look, at the end of the day, if this works and our efforts pay off to a real drug, you know, first and foremost, are we going to be able to finance this company at the valuation that we have? That's kind of the main question. Once we can get past that, then, you know, is it a realistic amount of money that goes in the next tranche that actually gets you to something that's really interesting and could be very valuable?
Great. Question more for Bristol and for Celgene in terms of metrics. If you're looking at a phase two or phase three compound, you guys have terrific capabilities in terms of running all the NPVs and POSs, et cetera. Do you apply those same metrics internally? In other words, do you look at, when you're doing your external analysis of opportunities and you have all those models, do you actually take that expertise and apply it internally and see what's better, external or internal?
We do that. When we look at external deals, we use the same, you know, methodology to value those assets. The issue, of course, is the devil you know versus you don't know. We know our assets a lot better, so we can hopefully have tighter bounds around those uncertainties. Whether we've done better with in-licensing or internal compounds, I'm not free to discuss.
George, your views, internal versus external in terms of rigor?
Yeah, the question really makes me smile. And the answer is yes. I think virtually every company I've worked with has done relatively similar metrics with respect to their internal compounds. I think, you know, we've all seen the data that, and it's debatable whether in-licensed compounds have higher success rate or not. Some of the data I've seen suggests they're slightly higher, and people get upset and say that's not true. I don't actually know, but what I do know is this. The big difference in every company I've worked in is once a compound is in development from your own R&D efforts or whatever, it has a life, and it's already a child in the family. And for most of you in the audience who probably have children, you know how you look at your children. It's a little bit different than the neighbor's child who throws a brick through the window or something versus your child. What I mean by that, I can give you a couple specific examples. So, and one of the great values, by the way, I think of a business development senior person to a management team in a company is to say in some of these meetings, well, guys, if this was an in-licensing candidate, would we take it on or not? So there was a compound at one company I worked for that had a 32-step synthesis, and it started to sputter. And, you know, it was like, let's put a few more Band-Aids on it, and let's, you know, give it a transfusion. And I remember saying, well, if we had a compound that had some serious safety issues and had a 32-step synthesis from an in-licensing perspective, you know, you guys would beat the hell out of me and throw me out of the room. And everybody laughed, and nothing happened. And then finally a patient or two died, and the drug was stopped. We had a very recent example where the drug was inhibiting CYP3A4 and had other issues. And I said, guys, you know, I'm going to, next one of these portfolio review meetings, I'm going to blind this up and say this is an in-licensing target, and what do you think will happen? And actually the CEO in this case laughed, and he goes, I know what would happen. But that took another year for that drug to die. So I do think that much of the same is true once you've actually in-licensed the compound and brought it into the portfolio. Once these things are running, it's really not so easy in most companies I've seen to kill them. It's much easier. I mean, people can be brutally objective about an in-licensing candidate when it's presented. And that's a good thing. They cannot be as brutally objective about their own compounds or a previously in-licensed compound that's already in the portfolio.
Terrific. Question for the...
Yes, one comment, since sure. George brought up children. I say children have a very high negative NPV.
We have a lot of, in the audience, a lot of physicians, a lot of scientists. And maybe if one or two of you could explain how you value the uncertainty. You know, probability of success, we've used that acronym POS, discount rate. Maybe you can just give the audience a little window into how you quantitatively, let's say for a phase two compound, where you know the indication, how do you think about the POS, probability of success, and how do you think about the discount rate?
So there's sort of three different ways you can do it. One is you can take historical rates, and you can break that down into small molecule versus biologic, by TA, that kind of thing. That's the very simplistic approach. And that can work if you have limited information about your compound. Often we use that for licensing deals where you don't have as much information on the compound. Next best is you know something about your compound, you bring in a group of experts, and you have a discussion around what do you think the probability of this study being successful is, so on and so forth. And then you get to a consensus number. That can be good, but that also has a lot of biases associated with it, as you can imagine. That can also bias internal projects higher than external, all the things you can imagine. What we actually do at BMS, which I think is actually not done anywhere else that I'm aware of, and I can't take credit for this, is we actually, for compounds where we have a development plan, we'll take a look, we'll sit with the team, and we'll model the probability of success. What we'll say is, so tell me what you believe. Let's pick an example. We have... Yervoy, our drug recently launched in melanoma. So we say, okay, we're now looking at non-small cell lung cancer. Tell me, based on what the data that you do have on Yervoy in non-small cell and other areas, what you think we call the truth about the drug is in terms of what it could do to increase overall survival in this study, and give me sort of your 10, 50, 90th percentile estimate of that. And it could be as low as maybe, you know, 0 months if you think it's going to have no benefit. It could be negative if you think it could potentially harm patients. Give me your median and give me your high case in terms of trying to encompass what you think the probability, the potential for this drug is in showing that. Then we do the same for the comparator arm, whether it's placebo or if it's standard of care, whatever it is. Those we can actually pull the data from studies and say, well, based on that, here's what we think that the spread for the comparator arm could be. we take those two and we actually run a model where we model the outcome of the study, you know, thousands of times doing typical Monte Carlo modeling, if you know how that works. And then we get a probability of that study being successful based on the estimates the team gave for the overall survival for the drug versus the comparator, how many times, you know, whether the drug is successful or not in the study, and it generates a number. And then you can take that number and you can, you know, discuss it further. Does this make intuitive sense? Is this going to be better than anything that's ever happened in non-small cell? You know, and then we can have those discussions and refine it. So that's kind of taking it to the next place. And we do all three depending on the situation, molecule, you know, how much the team gets engaged in the discussion.
Great. George, anything to add to that? Or?
I mean, I agree with most of that. I think generally, if it's an in-licensing candidate, I think that one looks at the well-known numbers that don't vary that much from various studies that have been done. So in oncology, you know what, starting phase one is 5%. If you're really an optimist, you might put it up to 10%. Going into phase two, 25%. Where it gets interesting is the data are pretty clear for pan-oncology pipeline across the industry. It's 50%, but, of course, probably anything that a significant company would be interested in licensing is going to be a bit better than that because you're going to be beyond the things that have jumped from phase one with 20 patients right into phase three. So I think for us, we take note of that, and we are very we try to stay kind of within those guidelines, except we look very factually at the case involved and look, we have this data, the randomized phase two was this many patients. And, you know, we might push it up a little bit, but it's awfully hard to give any compound in oncology that's at the beginning of phase three, you know, say more than a 70% probability of success. It's very hard to do that, right, if you're being honest.
Yep.
So,
thank you.
And this underscores the importance of if you are a company trying to grow your business, that it really is like investing in the stock market, dollar cost averaging. You have to have a portfolio of deals because any one deal, you know, the most sophisticated model I didn't do this model, but I have a good friend who works in an organization I won't name, but they did an incredibly sophisticated model. They had a lot of data, and they concluded this drug had a 92% chance of success in phase three. And guess what happened?
We can guess.
It blew up.
Let's go to the audience. Any questions? Yes, Ginny?
I'm struck by the amount of precision that you're trying to build into these models, and I'm mindful of the fact that experts in certain domains have limited expertise in other domains, and in particular, when you're in the middle of a probability distribution, what really is the difference between an expert who thinks there's a 60% chance, 70% chance, 40% chance? So, A, I wonder if what the venture capitalist said, that you need to have some vision here, isn't ultimately more important than intuition, and B, what kind of back-checking do you do retrospectively to see actually how good you've done, and how big a sample do you need before you can actually conclude that your process is robust?
Yeah, okay. I agree with you. I mean, that's why we put a pretty broad range, because realistically you have to. I didn't say this, but I really hate the whole sort of returns analysis part of our memo. Okay, I mean, I'm focused on the mechanism. I'm focused on the clinical strategy, and then again, you know, what's the chance of actually that biology is actually determining, you know, suggests that something is really important here. And one thing we didn't talk about, you know, layered on top of POS is really differentiation. You know, when you talk about payers or FDA or the buyers for us, whether it's public market or big pharma, that's got to be loud and clear. And you know, again, can we wait until the phase three is done to actually show that or not? A lot of times we can't, so we have to feel confident that we can do that before. So that plays a little bit more into the intuition and vision part of it, I think, layered on top of obviously the biology and understanding. You know, in terms of looking back, you know, looking back is a dangerous game for us, at least as venture capitalists, because the role of serendipity and right place, right time, when we can actually exit something, is enormous. And so, you know, there's a surprising number of times where the investment thesis didn't play out, but the exit was interesting. There's actually a handful of times where the investment thesis did play out, but the exit was horrible. And then there's a handful of times where the investments actually did play out, and the exit turned out to be to follow that. So we have to, you know, we're always trying to be open-minded to what the potential outcomes are going to be.
Jim?
Yeah, so I want to follow up on Dr. Drezowitz's comments. I think that the challenge here is generating a number that is an aggregate of point estimates where your confidence intervals are huge and almost always cover zero or something less than zero. And so one thing that we've been trying to do at Genentech is try to see how can we try to reduce those the confidence intervals, that is, get more precise about what the actual value is. And really there are only three things that derive this POS in our mind. One is that we know for sure. One is biologic versus small molecule. We know that biologics have about twice the chance of working as small molecules. So that's something I think we know with a fair amount of precision. The second thing, which we don't yet know, but which we are committed to, is companion diagnostics, because we think that also increases the probability of success. But we don't really know by how much it does, but we think it does. And the third thing, which is where we eventually end up, and I think Srini alluded to this, is that the largest driver of probability of success in our mind is the scientific hypothesis. And if you look at some of the stuff coming out of Pfizer, that may be a 10x number. If you don't know the mechanism of action going into phase two, the probability that drug will work actually is remarkably low. You can have great animal data. It can look like it's going to work in your model. But if you don't understand how, the chance that drug will actually make it into phase three and into patients is actually low. So what we end up with is we end up with focusing on the science as being the key thing that we do in order to make our analyses. And I think, you know, Srini was a student of that. The other thing that we look at is what is the cost to certainty, is it rather than return on investment. How much money do we really need to put into a project in order to get to the end of phase two in a study that we think will allow us to say yes or no? It's kind of your question about, you know, getting to a point where you think you put more money in.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's another metric we use.
Yeah, the critical go-no-go is, you know, certainly really important. And you know, something we talked about earlier is the opportunity cost, whether it's at pharma companies or small biotech companies, is something that's poorly understood and I think incredibly important. Just going back to one thing I glossed over in the slides, so I was, you know, eager to get through them and be done with them because they bore the hell out of me. I don't know about you guys. But the doing patient selection, you know, particularly in oncology, you know, we've more times than not tried to take the investment seriously when you can actually find a rationale, a biological rationale for a highly sensitive patient population and go into that study right away.
Yeah.
Question in the front.
Yeah, my question is, looking at all the discussion that's taking place, you boil it all down to dollars and cents, which is what you have to boil it down to. I haven't heard anything talk about people, because you can put all the money you want and you can put all the amount of effort you want. If you have the wrong people, which very often is the case, venture capitalists look at it very differently than big pharma, because big pharma has their own venture funds now. They're looking at it from co-development. They know they have the resources back home. They could help out if need be. But I haven't heard anything people. And, you know, you can model till you're blue in the face. And Harvard has done a great study years ago saying if you take a great product with bad people, you end up with a bad product. You take a bad product with great people, you might end up with a good product nonetheless. Well, and I think that's something that no one seems to address. The second part of my question is, talk about all the money and everything. It's regulatory climate. I mean, there's some great products just don't get through because the regulators just don't let them get through, and you keep pumping in more money and more money, and finally there comes some very drastic decision-making. Is it worth the effort any longer? And, of course, the patent keeps getting shorter and shorter, and you keep getting more and more nervous. So could you comment on that, please?
Yeah, I certainly comment on the first part of it. I may not have stressed it enough, but when I was commenting on the Avila deal, I did mention an absolutely great scientific team, and that we put really about half of the value of that deal on the platform. And a key element of that platform is the people who will stay on as an integrated unit where they are as part of Celgene. So I think that there are times where the people are extraordinarily important, and just about every company, when they're in that situation, does things to make sure that the critical people are retained and come over with the product or the technology. I will personally say my experience in the pharma world is that I agree that
not so good management team or team of people will probably screw up a good molecule. I must say, I have never seen a bad molecule, you know, that the greatest team in the world can make work. It just doesn't happen in our business. And in fact, the most stressful thing to see is a really good team that has their hands on a bad molecule and just can't get it to work, and that's not good. But I will say, my mentor in this business, a very senior physician who'd retired and come back, used to, one of the first things he told me is, when you go to these companies, you'll never see, you know, I mean, whenever you see a good molecule that's actually doing well, you'll see good people there. So I think it is something that people look at. It's just that typically, I just have to say, I think for most of these cases, if you're looking to bring a drug into Celgene from a licensing standpoint or an acquisition standpoint, and it's just the drug, it's not the platform, it really is about the data and the science much more than it's about the people. In an Ovilus situation, you bet. We're making sure that the key people stay on. Yeah. And I won't comment on regulatory except to say that I can't disagree with anything you said, but I think the regulatory climate in oncology, it's easy for me to say this, I'm not a regulator or I'm not responsible for getting NDAs approved, but it's actually better in oncology than almost any other therapeutic area. Unmet medical need is high. You can get away with safety issues that you would never get away with in other therapeutic areas. And at least in my personal experience, you know, PASDR is more rational than many of the other section heads.
Just a quick comment. You know, so that's where I was also going on the regulatory side with the differentiation, because I think that is going to be critical and continue. But no question, we look at that and we want to think about it. But again, for most of the investments that we do, it's probably not an issue that we're ultimately facing. We have to think through whether there is a path there that's going to make some sense. On the people side, it's absolutely, obviously very, very important. I didn't mean to gloss over that too much, but you know, we are fundamentally asset-based investors, and we will take the view that if we've got a great asset and we don't have great people behind it, we can find great people behind it. But that's really, really important. It's also what I was alluding to in terms of opportunity costs, where you find in venture over and over again, the successful CEOs or successful management teams are the ones that are able to make very difficult decisions. What happens is, you know, you can, it's easy to imagine, it's in human nature. If you've got one real asset in your company, maybe a couple of secondary, you know, second or tertiary asset, You focus all your energies on that lead asset, and you convince yourself that the data is not telling you something negative, that you can interpret it in a positive way. I mean, you know, the people who are running these small companies only have that one asset realistically. You know, they've given their, at least some portion of their career over to this, and you know, they're smart and they're thoughtful, but it's not that hard to convince yourself in that situation that this is still a meaningful product and we can get through this, we can do the next study. And the ones who are really successful are the ones who just say, you know what, it's not worth it. This, maybe there is a path there, maybe it's more complicated, but it's not worth it. We can spend our money more wisely somewhere else. And, you know, hopefully we invest in more of those kind of management teams than others.
Question, yes?
Yeah. So when you're evaluating a deal and also your own pipeline, do you actually look at your entire portfolio as well as your competitive portfolio in making those decisions? Because if multiple different compounds of different mechanisms in the same disease areas have a high likelihood or a medium likelihood of success, that means some of them are going to get approved, which actually might destroy the market for the compound that actually you thought was going to be approved. Another example is when I was at Pfizer, everybody's always trying to fill the gap that they don't have a particular mechanism that everybody else has. That doesn't seem like a very good investment strategy. Once an ALK inhibitor is approved and for 5% of non-small cell lung cancer, how many me-too ALK inhibitors do you need? So how much do you take the competition into account?
I mean, that's a big part of it, of course. And, you know, specifically within the therapeutic area, we do that. In terms of mechanism of action, if we have a gap in mechanism, it's not necessarily that we want to, you know, get into an arms race that everybody has to have a PI3 kinase or something. But we try to look for mechanisms that might have synergy with other compounds we already have. So if we have hedgehog pathway, that, you know, something that we can combine, because maybe the, you know, single agent activity is not going to be there, and we know that. So we try and bring in things that are going to help the overall pipeline, not necessarily just in terms of an arms race. Or if it is an arms race, then we look for something that we know is far behind, but it's going to have some toxicity angle, or there's going to be something that's a lot better about it, even if it's already on the market.
Yes. This question relates more to late-stage assets. When we used to run a lot of models at Genentech in oncology for these, there's this insinuation from the panel that this NPV can be a certain number, but often that number would easily be dwarfed. The debates around market share or which tumor type you might succeed in would be dwarfed by tax rates and cost of capital, which would be a huge spread depending on if you're a multinational company or a small biotech. How do you bridge that gap? Do you go in and you're open kimono about what tax rates, what cost of capital you're going to use? Because that number could change a lot depending on who you're talking to.
I mean, quickly, to any of you who've built models, just go in there and change the discount rate that you use by 1 or 2%. I mean, you can get a model to say anything you want, and it's, you know, I'll be open here, but, you know, I'm trained as a scientist. I have great financial colleagues who are critical, but they're and this goes back to the comment that the gentleman over here made about, you know, having some, boldness or courage. I think there are companies who historically have been much more wedded to what the model says than others, in my experience. And I think those who are wedded to a DCF model in say, M&A circumstances, I can go back and look and see how many M&As they've done versus most of the rest of the industry. And guess what? It's a relatively low number. And I think that it is about appropriate risk-taking. So the better companies and CEOs, and from the deal perspective at least, understand, and it's much more important to use a model to test sensitivity. What happens if I get a 10% higher price? You know, what happens if, you know, you get a patent extension and, you know, 3 years is almost automatic. What if I get 5 years? And so I think most companies, particularly as they've been pressured to find new drugs, and that's getting more and more difficult, have gotten a lot better about looking at models as models. What's the sensitivity? But I have lived through times where the model was almost like an oracle that spit out a number, and that's very frustrating.
Yeah, I'd just like to follow up a little bit on that, a little bit in defense of modeling. You know, what George said is correct. If you ever go with a point estimate, you know it's wrong. So, I mean, the value in doing these models is not the output. It's the discussions that you have with development teams. It's all relational. So if you can say that for this molecule, this development path, the bounds of uncertainty are here in terms of, you know, ENPV or whatever that is, and for this one it's over here, then you know they don't overlap. So you already have some insights there. If you can come up with alternative development strategies that change uncertainties, whether that's probability of success, in a relational way, not necessarily that this one's 23 and this one's 32. The numbers themselves don't matter, but it's the movement you can make between those values in terms of different strategies for development, in terms of comparing molecules. I think that's more valuable. The danger is, though, that once it goes to a governance review and you see that one number, everybody focuses on that and they say, oh, the ENPV is 27.269, da 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 da, right? When really the range is from negative 500 million to potentially a billion, and hopefully you come up with ways to narrow that range. And if you can do a phase two study that's going to narrow that range, that's worthwhile information, while the ENPV of 27 is not.
Yeah, and most companies, I think the leaders of most companies are pretty good at understanding. But the speech that I frequently have given is, so in the case of Abraxas, for example, Celgene really wanted to get into the solid tumor business, and we had looked at everything available. And, you know, it's not like you are looking to buy a house or a car where if that one isn't available, well, who cares? There are 1,000 more available. A decent drug or a decent asset, there are usually not too many alternatives. So to me, the model is actually really useful at telling me and my colleagues when it's just completely irresponsible to spend this much money. And I think whether any of us like it or not, there is a point where you're irresponsible to your shareholders, you're irresponsible to your employees by spending, you know, $10 billion for a drug that's only worth $3 billion, and if you punch the model, it's only worth $4 billion. But it is absolutely not a single number.
I'll close with one question over here. Yep.
I'd really be interested if the panel truly believes that there'll be continued investment in oncology going forward. I mean, by venture capital, big pharma deals. Given what some of the audience members have said today, which I believe is a more difficult regulatory environment, certainly a more difficult market access environment, but also given the fact that given the smaller and smaller patient populations and the competition that we see in places like metastatic breast cancer, kidney cancer certainly, maybe even lung cancer and prostate cancer, what I see is the recently approved drugs are more like $200 to $400 million drugs, not billion or $2 billion drugs. So is the investment really still going to be there as opposed to other therapeutic areas?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. The venture business for biotech is under a hell of a lot of pressure, whether it's oncology or anything else. As I said before, it's an irrational, you know, it's a rational business. You know, I can't justify to you on paper why the hell I'm doing what I'm doing. So, you know, but hopefully I can keep doing it for a little while because it's fun. But and every once in a while it works. So we're going to – I think that's going to continue, unfortunately. That's just a reality. I do think that in oncology, at least, we can mitigate that a little bit by, you know, as we talked about, understanding the biology a little bit more and going for a better patient selection and hopefully find some patients. And, you know, luckily there's good – it's not just – this isn't just a fairy tale, right? And we've seen really good examples of this over the last several years of very, very high response rates in a highly selected patient population. And I hope that we can continue to do that. You know, I do think that it is worth noting, though, that the – problems in venture for biotech investments have been there for some time, and it's led to, you know, you've all heard about the innovation gap, I guess, and that gap is there, it's growing. And I do think that there's been fewer and fewer early stage, you know, exciting discoveries that are coming out of universities that are being funded by venture capitalists. And I think that's unfortunate. I really do think it's bad for the entire industry. As pharma has cut back, you know, significantly on their R&D, their requirement, in my view at least, you can disagree if you want, I'd love to hear your point of view, but I think my assumption is that the dependence of venture-backed companies is going to be greater, particularly for the first-in-class therapeutics. So we've got to, as an industry, you know, together got to figure out a way to get these really high-risk, early-stage discoveries into the drug discovery pathway. Doing it purely academically, I think, is not going to be successful. So there's got to be some kind of, better collaborations that actually incentivize both sides to get molecules that are going to be first class and move them forward. And then, realistically, as venture capitalists, we can, for the most part, are going to be able to jump in at that point. So, you know, I guess the answer to your question is it's tough and getting tougher, and hopefully we can try to be, you know, that'll inspire everybody to be a little more creative.
I'll close with one observation. If we were here 26 years ago, the hottest molecule preclinically was recombinant human tumor necrosis factor. I was on Wall Street. The question was, is that $1 billion or $2 billion in sales? Everybody was convinced. New York Times had a front page story, and obviously giving recombinant human TNF wiped out the people, not the tumor. Fast forward, today the largest category in biotech is blocking TNF. So just keep that in mind. Let's break for lunch. Thank you.
So lunch is in the Broadway ballroom, which is on the third floor, and we'll be back here at 1:30.